were driven without cable since, by the way, and neither should you. And I found them at a large photography studio. The 40-by-80-foot white room was very barren, and the photographer told me he knew right where the jumper cables were because he was moving. "Oh, really?" I replied, and immediately took down the landlord's information. "Yeah," he said, "I used to do a killer business shooting the cover photos for VHS porn movies." "You don't say," I replied, looking at the expanse in a new light indeed. "Were my boots lightly sticking to the concrete floor?" "Oh, yeah, the money was great," he said, "'cause the photo on the box is what gets your rental at the video store. Think about it. But the video store is dying. I can't afford to stay." He then toured me around the huge room, upon the walls of which were still poster-sized versions of some of the photos he had accomplished there, in this empty, dusty warehouse. There was a sandy beach scene, complete with water, and a snowy ski bunny hillside with pine trees and a cabin, and on, every photo with a scantily clad sex pot in a coy pose of one sort or another. "Well, I'm sure things will work out," I said, licking my chops. "No, not at the Chesty Morgans, but at the potential shop space." I got the place, and with Marty's help, turned it into a woodworker's dream shop, where I still ply my troth to this day. Mr. McClendon, a good friend about whom I've written a limerick, and I'll just tell you the first line, "There once was a man named McClintercourse." He and I both owe an undeniable debt of gratitude to Fine Woodworking magazine for the expert tutelage it has given us over the years. We have read that magazine cover to cover every month, completely infatuated with the classified ads in back. I could tell you where to get Tiger Maple in Virginia, or what gentleman in Ohio will tune up your antique molding planes for you. I'm the same way with Wooden Boat magazine, which is about as delicious as a periodical can get. When Marty and his winning bride, Jennifer, were blessed with a bun in the oven, I was able to realize a dream that had been percolating for a while, thanks to the Wooden Boat classifieds. A fellow named Warren Jordan had plans available to purchase for the Baby Tender, which is a lapstrake planked rowboat built to the scale of a cradle. It even hangs on custom davits. You can bet your sweet caboose I built that little boat for Marty and Jen with a hull of Alaskan yellow cedar and black walnut trim. Witnessing the hull of a boat take shape upon your bench is like spinning a Corvette from wool. There be witchcraft afoot in the boat shop, sure now. We continued to leapfrog off of each other, attempting projects ever increasing in difficulty. Ours was a beautiful partnership, fueled by the sounds of Kool and the Gang, the Gap Band, Parliament, and Funkadelic. Sadly for me, Marty was called back to Wisconsin to merely run an entire college theater department, the Lord's work indeed, but we both still love to send each other pictures of our most recent sweet joinery. I could never have learned all that I have so far without his collaboration. In the last year, our circle of life has gone full-on Hakuna Matata as we have both realized the crazy sex dream of writing articles for Fine Woodworking. Who shot who in the what now? Check out Fine Woodworking number 231 to see McClendon's green and green style bed in American cherry, but don't look at it unless you're prepared to blow your load. Hooked on boats but good, I then had the chance to build my first canoe, Huckleberry, and shoot a how-to video of the process for Ted Moores and Joan Barrett of Bear Mountain Boats in Peterborough, Ontario, the premier company for all of your canoe building needs. That's Bear Mountain Boats. Ted literally wrote the book, Canoe Craft, on building cedar strip canoes and kayaks, a manual from which I learned to find my ass with both hands and many more techniques even more efficacious. Jimmy DiResta shot the video and earned himself my second canoe, Lucky Boy, as part of his recompense. These canoes are designed by Ted and Steve Killing, and I will reiterate that when the hull begins to reveal its voluptuous curves to the builder, boners there be, and that goes for the ladies as well. Experiencing a problem with depression? Ennui got you down? Build a goddamn canoe, and trust me, you will be happy as a clam at high tide. Most of the work is done with hand tools, which means you get to crank your tunes for hours of pleasure. Check out Any Tom Waits or Petra Haden Sings The Who Sellout. Trust me. Iron and Wine is amazing on the Spokeshave. I also played a lot of Supreme Music Program, a band fronted by Megan Mullally, whose three albums are like fully formed novels. Lady got pipes, y'all. Even the paddle of the canoe can prove to be an immensely satisfying undertaking, and a place I often suggest that beginners choose as their starting point. It's great training in the block plane and the spokeshave, and there's nothing so gratifying as crafting a handled tool from wood. To date, I've carved a spoon and a fork, several canoe paddles, a life-size replica mahogany axe, and a baseball bat. The moment of enchantment occurs when the item is nearing completion and you're sanding the shaft or handle. You can begin to feel the work that this tool will perform, whether it be wrapping out a triple or paddling against a brisk current. I can tell you from many hours of experience that propelling a wooden canoe that you have built with a paddle also made by your hand carries so much more than a sense of pride. One begins to tap into the primal ingenuity that strings us together with countless generations of our clever forebears who collectively did all of the long division for us when it came to sailing and aerodynamics and, well, every sort of simple machine, really. When I paddle across the big water, I feel a direct kinship with my ancestors in that we have both cheated the river. With the chair and the table, we outsmart gravity. With the boat, we outsmart water and wind and distance. Lest we get too cocky, though, as soon as I, start to think this way, my nature slaps us, me, with a squall and dumps my canoe over a submerged tree trunk, reminding me that behind that spokeshave there still stands a jackass. Chapter 14. Romantic Love. Engage in romantic love. It truly makes life worth living. Romance affords you the opportunity to do a lot of giving, which I believe I've read is said to be better than receiving. Trust me, once you give of your time and care to your loved one, you'll be doing a plenty of receiving, if you follow me. If you don't follow me, I'm saying you'll be having a bunch of oral sex performed upon you. One might examine the example of a triumphant marriage set for me by my mom and dad and determine that I was hopelessly lost to a life of romance from the outset. I'm not talking the saccharine stuff of Disney films. I'm referring to down-to-earth everyday give and take. A bouquet of sweet williams gathered along the fence row on the way home to mom. Making sure Dad got the bone with the marrow at dinner, which he shared with me, good man. Little commonplace gestures that say, I'm thinking of you. The reason some may see my sappy side as a liability is that when faced with a decision, I will damn near always choose the more romantic or foolish choice. To wit, a mere couple of months into our courtship, my wife Megan took a major plunge by coming to my family's annual fishing week in remote northwest Minnesota. I was pretty nervous, as the accommodations are pleasant but spartan, and Megan would be meeting most of my family for the first time. These cabins are for fisher folk and hunters, not vacationing legends of the entertainment world, so I wanted to go the extra mile or three to make it nice for my new lady. We arrived to a beautiful afternoon, light on the mosquitoes, and we were happy to see the gang. I suggested we take the pontoon boat out across the lake to get a romantic view of the sunset. Megan agreed, so we snagged a bottle of wine and puttered away. For those who don't know, a pontoon, also known as a party barge, is a good-sized rectangular floor, say 10 by 18 feet, floating upon two pontoon floats, like two long cylindrical skis, with seating for 12 or so, and a nice size but not overly macho motor, 35 to 50 horsepower. It's the minivan of the lake. There's a retractable awning on the pontoon for shade, rendering the vessel a very comfortable place from which to catch one's limit or just enjoy a cold can of suds while taking in some of the cheese curds one collected on one's way through Wisconsin and admire the majestic scenery. Or, say, shut down the motor, drift, and soak up the sunset with your new crazily foxy bombshell. Traditionally, and in order to comply with the law, a boater will turn on small lights at dusk so that other watercraft can see him or her and thereby prevent collisions from occurring. I understand the prudence in this rule, so I flipped on the parking lights and we had a glass of wine and discussed our burgeoning feelings, as well as my brother-in-law's penchant for the Black Russian cocktail, while the sun set beautifully over the pine forest in which the cabin resort sat. If I do say so myself, this was a pretty devastating atmosphere of a moor in which I had festooned our evening. Romeo-wise, I was looking pretty savvy. By the time the breeze picked up and blew us directly into the far shore opposite our dock, it was fully dark and time to head in for some late-night snacks and euchre. When I turned the key to fire up the motor, the silence that greeted me was one of the most violent sounds I'd ever not heard. I knew immediately what had befallen us, thanks to a storied history of misunderstanding motor vehicles throughout my youth. I'd left the maritime equivalent of the parking lights turned on without the motor running. Silence is romantic. And the battery had been drained past the capability of answering our ignition needs. This was very bad. The lake was completely dark. A brisk breeze was blowing us against the shore directly across the lake from our destination. There was nary a light as far as the eye could see, as this whole side of the lake was a preserve used by the Boy Scouts, who were fully absent at this time. In short, I had no choice but to attempt to compel the pontoon the mile and a half back across the water. But how? I screamed a few times at the top of my lungs for my brother, who was no doubt five beers into a euchre game back at the cabin. Christ almighty. I searched clumsily through the storage areas beneath the bench seats and burst into inward tears of thanks when I came upon a pathetic warped canoe paddle. It was incredibly lightweight and curved so severely that if I had a pair of them, I could have made a kick-ass rocking chair with some exciting action. But given the circumstances, I had never seen a more beautiful wooden implement in all of my life. I proceeded to sit on the front center of the pontoon and set to paddling for all I was worth, not much at that moment, for about 3 hours, directly into the wind, while Megan poured swigs of wine into my mouth and sang a progression of songs into my ear. Songs of love, like Randy Newman's Real Emotional Girl and Marie, Tom Waits' Johnsburg, Illinois and Ruby's Arms, and her show-stopping version of Danny Boy. The bees of love came swirling around me in a swarm of passion, coalescing in the air before me like a large cartoon fist, before soundly bludgeoning me into servitude. I couldn't stop and rest because of the severe headwind, so I set my jaw and paddled like a Phoenician, literally guiding myself by the Big Dipper until we floated safely into the dock. Standing on the dock, spent, under the stars, my then-girlfriend told me she loved me. Using my gifts of stubbornness and mulish stamina, I had achieved a romantic triumph that I might hope to repeat in our years of bliss, but preferably by less taxing means. When we arose the next morning, my family was disappointingly nonplussed at the recounting of my Homeric episode. Refusing to believe that I hadn't killed the battery on purpose to provide myself a juicy opportunity to impress my lady. That hurt, but not nearly as much as what happened next. My dad took me out to the pontoon and showed me where the top pops off the motor and one could use a pull rope to start it up, in case the battery should die. The Offermans, ladies and gentlemen. Inexplicably, but thankfully, Megan stuck with me. It wasn't long before Cupid sat me down and said, "You know what's up, right?" And I said, "Yes, your work here is replete and seamless, and I will answer it." Megan and I had openly discussed the plan to one day marry, so I didn't feel terribly sweaty about making a proposal happen at first. After some water had passed under the bridge, however, it became clear that I should get the ball rolling, maybe after a year together. One day we were walking down Beverly Boulevard in L.A., and I was pulling my Swiss Army knife out of my pocket, as is my habit, and I also accidentally pulled out a quarter, which went tinkling onto the sidewalk. As I abruptly took a knee to retrieve the coin and replace it in my pocket, inadvertently striking the exact posture and gesture of a man traditionally proposing marriage, even down to the hand in my pocket, Megan facetiously said, "Oh my God, honey!" And I, ever game, played along as though I had awkwardly lost the ring. I stammered. I think I lost a nickel. Hilarious. We laughed long and hard and pressed on to our destination, while in the back of my mind, a switch had been thrown. The placard beneath that switch read, "Many a true word is spoken in jest." I don't know who writes the copy for these switches of mine, but they need to update their vernacular, bro. Anyway, the story of my muffed proposal made the rounds, and everyone agreed that it was a terrific chuckle. The foundation of the humor was to be found in our confidently solid romance. Acquaintances would sometimes exhibit alarm that I might play so fast and loose with a lady's expectations, but I would never risk hurting Megan's feelings, and she knew that, so the subject remained ripe for further ribaldry. About this time, I was getting incredibly excited about a trip to Paris that we had coming up. Around the set of Will and Grace, I mentioned that it might be even funnier to extend my run of proposal comedy in the City of Lights. Without missing a beat, the costume designer, the sublime Lori Eskowitz, handed me a selection of gorgeous engagement rings of the costume jewelry variety, which I gratefully and surreptitiously pocketed. Cut to Gay Paris. Holy shit. You guys, there is a city in France called Paris, directly south of Amiens. It's on the Seine, and you should totally go check it out. We were absolutely swept away by the romance and beauty and history of that magnificent burg. Paris is indeed for lovers. We thrilled at buying crepes with butter and sugar from a street vendor and then just sojourning about the arrondissement, neighborhoods arranged in a spiral pattern by number, soaking in the architecture, the people, the museums, the food, the flowers, and I was especially freaked out by the Art Deco designs of the Paris metro stops, done by Hector Guimard at the turn of the 20th century. So much so that I did some homework and sought out a couple of apartment buildings he had also assembled. Such beautiful and highly crafted work. We were high on the hill of Montmartre, visiting the Basilica of Sacré-Cœur, then just swooning at the majestic views of the city from this, the highest point. At the base of the ancient stone steps leading to the church, I suddenly dropped to my knees again, and this time pulled out a pretty bitchin' diamond ring. I launched into, "Megan, you know I love you." But my words were cut short when I bobbled the ring and it flipped a few times in the air before neatly dropping into the ancient iron gutter grate over which I was kneeling. Ever willing, Megan did not bat an eyelash, saying, "Oh my God, Nick, what was that?" "Nothing. I mean, I just dropped a 20 centime piece." Terrific. We had a nice laugh and then continued touring that historic hilltop, which once housed the studios of artists like Picasso, Dali, Modigliani, Manet, Van Gogh, Mondrian. Not a bad lineup. I'm telling you, Paris is totally worth it. I don't know why nobody ever talks about it. It's in France, everybody. Some of the finest gustatory experiences in the world can also be found in this foxy bitch of a European capital. We got some good tips from friends on some places to dine, including an incredibly romantic cafe on the left bank of the Seine. So romantic that it felt like we were sucking on one string of spaghetti together in Lady and the Tramp, and our post-dinner stroll along the Seine was a dream. We crossed the river on the resplendent Pont Neuf Bridge. So pretty. Why has no one used it in a movie? Woody Allen, please check it out. Which, thinking back on it now, was like an unrealizable fantasy of what I'd always thought a love trip should be. In the middle of our crossing, I took Megan by her two arms and placed her just so. Then I backed up about 5 steps to take a gallant rolling start into my kneeling, but as I began to step to her, I unfortunately tripped and barreled straight into the bridge's sidewall, catching the rail soundly in my gut, which folded me over the wall, sending the impressive diamond ring in my hand catapulting into the night air. Flipping cinematically end over end, catching the lights of the night city in its several expertly cut facets, the ring plummeted, as if in slow motion, disappearing into the murky waters of the Seine. Can you imagine how embarrassing this was for me? 2 incredibly expensive diamonds lost. Not to mention, I'd twice made a complete botch job of proposing to my devastatingly beautiful girlfriend. Megan and I laughed again, sincerely enjoying the now running gag, but not so much as to take away from the sheer bliss of our romantic evening. Near the end of our trip, after we had visited the Louvre Museum extensively, and I had successfully photographed myself shirtless among the centaurs in the sculpture garden, those Louvre security guards are no joke. Hey, somebody should totally set a movie there. That would be cool. Anyway, we figured that no trip to Paris would be complete without ascending La Tour Eiffel, the Eiffel Tower. It was later in the evening, which turned out to be a good move, as the daytime tourist crowds can be a bit much around the tower. We rode to the top in an elevator, and it's really about as breathtaking as you might imagine. Both for its sweeping views and, for me anyway, probably more than Milady, the engineering and scale of this 1,000-foot tower. I do love to see how we humans put things together. As you might have guessed, since comedy does tend to come in threes, I was feeling so swept away by this romantic pinnacle that I dropped to one knee and casually dropped the 3rd and largest ring through the grated floor of the Eiffel Tower, where it plummeted some 900 feet to the park below. Never fear, I had carefully scouted the area to ensure I wouldn't accidentally plant it in someone's cranium when it fell. Megan was gratifyingly entertained by my buffoonery, something I continue to appreciate to this day. This brought to a close my famous hat trick of bungled proposals in the most passion-inducing city I've laid eyes on. I can't believe nobody knows about Paris. You should Google it. These japes were good, clean fun, but the onus was rather on me now. If I was willing to joke so freely about the subject, then it was only appropriate that I man up and deliver the real goods at some point. Make my leavings or get out of the water closet, as it were. Some months later, I managed to pull off the real thing in London on another lovely vacation. I had secured a custom ring with my paycheck from acting in a Fox pilot, made with a modest but beautiful stone in a gypsy setting, a favored detail which I had previously ferreted out of my beloved. We were walking through Regent's Park, and we came upon Queen Anne's Rose Garden, which I had secretly selected from several proposed locations by our local guide. As we strolled along hand in hand, I shit you not, all of the insects were buzzing and courting in the air all around us. The birds and chipmunks were giggling and fluttering about, and the ducks in the stream were coupled off, engaged in some heavy petting. As I slowed to a stop upon a little wooden bridge and pulled my insurance from my pocket, a heart-shaped box carved in walnut which hinged open to reveal the ring perfectly inset. And dropped to one knee, all of nature seemed to begin copulating around us, beating the very air into a syrup of carnal ecstasy. Pairs of pretty sparrows furiously 69ing pinwheeled through the air like feathery filleting fireworks. The calla lilies were nodding approval at me as they began to gently buttfuck one another. In hindsight, I may not have been completely right, as my heart was beating out of my chest. Something magical was certainly in the air. Spoiler alert, my wife said yes. The best part of my blissful life was now promised to continue by mutual agreement between myself and the cause of said bliss. Naturally, it wasn't long before we began a series of discussions about throwing ourselves a wedding. One of the first events we'd attended as a couple was Deborah Messing's beautiful wedding on the coast above Santa Barbara, which was an absolute fairy tale. The breathtaking scenery was complemented by the large gathering of family and friends, a group in which I was flattered to be newly initiated. The one brief moment of displeasure occurred when a paparazzi helicopter suddenly appeared to snatch photos and video of the resplendent fete. Enormous efforts had been expended toward maintaining the secrecy of the particular details surrounding the nuptials, but alas, there always seems to be some asshole willing to sell out one's privacy and comfort for a buck. The rest of the evening went off without a hitch, and I was powerfully excited to meet the cast and producers of Will and Grace for the first time. Of course, the topic of the evil helicopter later came up in our own summit for the planning of our own wedding, and so we began to devise methods by which we might successfully avoid such an interruption from the parasites that pathetically invade people's privacy for a paycheck. I am still enamored of my first pitch, but I understand why it would have been a bad idea. The notion was this. Megan was nominated for an Emmy for the fourth year in a row, of an eventual seven, and I suggested that we ditch the Emmys and hold our wedding in secret during the awards ceremony. You have to admit that no one would have seen it coming, plus all the scumbags would have been otherwise detained, carnivorously trying to nab a shot of Doris Roberts' nip-slip on the red carpet. Megan liked the idea, but ultimately decided it would have been disrespectful to play such a trick on the Academy and the Will and Grace family, so we came up with the next best ruse. Inviting our immediate families to town to attend the Emmys was easy, and we had recently purchased our first house together in the Hollywood Hills, so we simply invited 20 of our family and friends over for a casual dinner the night before the Emmys. Our guests arrived and had a lot of oohing and aahing to do at our new digs. I call it the house that Will and Grace built because at the time Megan was in charge of things like the mortgage and I was in charge of expenses like supplying the household with toilet paper. I also believe the purchase of beer fell into my bailiwick. So we were both contributing. Nobody designs an interior like Milady. So our guests were well preoccupied with cocktails and visual splendor when we announced, "Now, friends and loved ones, will you please step into the yard, because this is our wedding." Mothers wept. There was a joy and also jubilation and some tears from the coterie in general. The evening was quite magical, with the entire ceremony taking place in front of our spectacular sweeping view of Los Angeles as our guests looked on. There was more crying, which I hope and believe were tears of happiness and not, "What the hell is she thinking?" My favorite part of the evening was how gorgeous my wife looked, as well as her willingness to make such a promise to me, to stick together as long as we were both still hanging around this big blue marble. A vow of this ilk is literally once in a lifetime if you're lucky, and I think a person's odds of being lucky in that department increase drastically if the person means that simple vow when he or she makes it. Life is unpredictable, We have no way of knowing what might befall us in the next 5 minutes, let alone 30 years down the road. But the weight a marriage vow carries is that in the face of that very uncertainty, two people are willing to promise to stick it out together. That's my favorite part. As I mentioned previously, my sensei, Shozo Sato, came to town and performed a wedding tea ceremony as part of the proceedings, which was also exceptionally special to both Megan and myself. He mixed a special bowl of green tea, from which Megan and I sipped, as well as our parents. If you ever have the opportunity to experience a Japanese tea ceremony, I can't recommend it highly enough. Sato-sensei is a master of the form, and it was a great privilege to have our hearts joined by his ministrations. The simple grace with which I had seen him excel through art and life for the 14 years I'd known him was one of the most touching ingredients in the bouillabaisse of our evening. A beautiful and rousing mariachi band finished off the perfect recipe for our tiny secret wedding. And I reckon it looks like it worked, since we're about as sappy for each other today as we were on that night 10 years ago, if not more so. People often remark to us that they're pleasantly surprised to see a marriage last as long as ours in Hollywood, which is a very sad thing to say about Hollywood. One of the main reasons I think we are succeeding has to do with our propensity to stay home and be boring. We don't get caught up in the business here in town, meaning going out all the time to parties and bars and so forth. We are unencumbered by the need to be seen. When we see a red carpet, we head the other way, if at all possible. Of course, some of this silliness is necessary, as part of our work is to promote projects in which we appear, but we do try to keep even that to a minimum. We prefer instead to stay home and read books. We do jigsaw puzzles or play cards. We watch movies. We make our relationship a priority so that it will survive all of the tumult, usually good tumult, that our jobs throw into our paths. A marriage bond needs a healthy elasticity so that when one of us is suddenly touring Australia for 10 days, the bond will stretch between here and down under without breaking. We have a strict rule. We never accept any employment that will keep us apart for more than 2 weeks. In 13 years together and counting, we've only been apart for 2 weeks a couple of times, and even that sucked balls. Megan and I have both experienced the benefit of some powerfully good fortune in our lives, which I believe means that at some point we'll see some low points to balance things out, as life tends to do. I am grateful beyond description to know that when we find ourselves in those doldrums, I will have a partner as smart and funny and supportive and strong and creative and loving as my wife. Her killer set of jugs also does not hurt my feelings. Love your woman. A paean to Megan. Megan Mullally. Love time? She is the reason for the season. My best friend, my legal property, my wife. I could honestly write a book solely devoted to my wife, and maybe I will, by gum, because there is at least a volume's worth of amazing magic glistening about her person that'll thrill you to pieces, and render you extremely envious of the fact that she is, in fact, my legal possession in the state of California. Read the paperwork. Many know, adore, and rightly lust after her as Karen Walker, the gut-bustingly hilarious Stack of Curves on Will and Grace, one of the finest 30-minute comedy programs ever to bless our airwaves and our living rooms, but I know her by some different names, particularly around the house. Names like Gettin' Juggy With It, Queen of My Pants and the Known Universe, Pandora's Box, Venus and Then Some, Ark of the Covenant, The Bush, and of course, Stacy Beaverhouse. I met her when I was 28, working on a production of The Berlin Circle at Los Angeles Evidence Room Theater, a company we promptly joined and one to which we continue to offer our fealty. Artistic director Bart DiLorenzo, a dear friend and genius of the stage, was one of the main influences that allowed Megan the opportunity to absolutely save my life from myself. And we quickly fell into the grip of an ardor that only continues to grow, thank the pagan gods and their dogs. This chapter, then, is a song of joy, hollered directly at her beautiful face area. You check out those cheekbones? Fuck me silly. Also, if you don't already have it bookmarked, do a Google image search for Megan Mullally boobs and check out that first picture that comes up. Right? I have oft enjoyed the word paean in my reading to describe just such a song of worship, and so I thought to discover the proper pronunciation as I had never actually heard it uttered aloud. A few different friends gave me a few different opinions, so imagine my chagrin when I learned from the internet that it is pronounced paean. Perhaps I'll just stick with hymn of praise. I suppose I'll start off the jamboree with a salute to another of her characters, the sexually insatiable Elizabeth in Mel Brooks' absolutely top-drawer Broadway musical Young Frankenstein. By the way, if you ever get the chance to see Miss Mullally tread the boards, especially if she's warbling a tune, run, don't walk. She makes a noise of pulchritude that would have made Ethel Merman hurl her boa to the stage in defeat and trudge off glumly to the pub. The never-ending cavalcade of chuckles that was Young Frankenstein included Megan's show-stopping number Deep Love, a roaring, throaty, filthy tribute to the rigid, trunk-like love member of the Frankenstein monster. By the end of the song, she was downstage in a single spotlight, barefoot in a torn dress, singing her tits off, as she likes to say of others, to such effect that the subsequent blackout regularly brought the audience to their feet, like they were at a rock concert. Have I made it clear that I am a fan? For opening night, I put together this little ditty in the hopes that Mr. Brooks would bring me on as a writing partner, or at least a backstage broom. Still hoping for a call, Melvin. I give you Elizabeth. Chaste in all her speech, but a terror in the sack. Like a full-force Irish gale, on her feet or on her back. The voice of sweetest songbird, with the gaiety of a fawn. Fellows brawl to rise and fall in labor on her lawn. When she shops for diamonds or simply cuts a rug, they say that she's a handful, aye, a handful of jug. She's God's gift to men, oh, she's keen to unwrap it. When the moon is in its wane, it's held that she can snap it. So if you wear the tackle nature gave man for love, then huzzah for Elizabeth. She is heaven from above and below. My wife was born with a very unfair portion of talent. She seems to excel at whatever task on which she lays her hand. She decided to cut our poodle's hair, and an hour later they came out of the bathroom looking like they had just been drawn by someone who draws the very cutest of cartoon animals. Not content to rest on her God-given skills, however, Megan has inspired me again and again throughout our years together with her steady work ethic. For some reason, I grew up with the misconception, or fantasy, really, that when a person made it in showbiz, they would no longer need to work very hard. I figured that once you hit the big time, you got to just chill in your trailer, smoking a ton of the finest weed, then head in and kill a few scenes on camera, then go meet David Lee Roth at the beach to hang out with some bikini-clad models. Ah, puberty. It sells the shit out of some Bieber records, right? Or whatever dross from the Disney factory is passing for popular music today. Anyway, it turns out that these people at the top of their respective games in the entertainment industry don't, in actuality, smoke much weed at all, while working 12 to 16-hour days. Because weed is a sedative. Sedatives, whilst mighty pleasing, well, they slow you down. Turns out, the time to party is after work. I saw my wife rehearse every Will and Grace scene to the point of perfection, and every song to within an inch of its life, driven by a desire to give the audience the most profound enjoyment possible. As I may have mentioned earlier, I quite enjoy hard work, but I had never seen anyone work without being flogged by a coach nearly as hard as my wife. This was a revelation. I realized that success on her level was only achievable through a gift of talent, consistent hard work to back up the talent, and a healthy portion of good luck on top of it. This is but one of the many, many lessons I have been gifted by the lady with the heavenly poonts who calls me husband. Early in our relationship, we were in New York City, where Megan was engaged in some press for Will and Grace. In a Lincoln Town Car, the vehicle of note for NYC press work, we were running maybe 10 minutes late for an appearance she was to make on Letterman, a show of which I was and still am a very big fan. My late Grandpa Ray and I used to watch Dave, and the fact that all the fancy East Coast types appreciate his dry Midwestern sense of humor has always made me feel all the more comfortable when rubbing elbows with the cognoscenti myself. That makes it quite simple to comprehend why I would be completely panicked that we were going to be late to late night, even though I was merely the husband along for the ride. Our driver pulled up to the stage door where there were 8 or 10 people on the sidewalk waiting for Megan, hoping for an autograph. Of course, I barreled through them and opened the door for Megan, only to turn around and find that she was signing away.
What was this?
Once she had finished giving them some of her time, which amounted to all of 2 minutes, maybe 3, she came inside and we got into the elevator to ascend to her dressing room. Once alone, I unleashed my righteous indignation. What are you thinking? You're already late for Dave. She replied, Darling, if it wasn't for the fans on the sidewalk and the fans in general, I wouldn't be on Letterman in the first place. Properly admonished, I stared at the lit round button that read 5B in shame. The elegance with which she has always handled herself in such public situations continues to be a master class that I attend daily. On a more personal note, another of Megan's sublime talents resides in her acumen for interior design. It's an art that obsesses her to approximately the same degree which I am enthralled by woodworking. Only she can decorate an entire room in the time it takes me to build half of a table. She has turned our home into such a work of surprising beauty that I am often caused to giggle when I trudge in from a day at the shop, covered in sawdust, at the idea that I should reside in a house as inventively appointed as this. Her color palette is intensely modern, using accents and shades that I could never have fathomed working in concert. What's more, she's an amazing collector of art, which is an attribute I appreciate very powerfully, as I am much inspired by the paintings and drawings that festoon our walls, even the ones with no naked ladies. Let's see. We've discussed beauty, talent, artistry, elegance. Ah! I see I've buried the lead. Megan's finest trait, even more apparent than the glorious volcanoes of flesh gracing her upper abdomen, is her sense of humor. She has, without question, the filthiest, most hilarious predilection for phrases and gestures that would make a sailor's cock ring blush. When we became friends in rehearsals for the Berlin Circle, I would race home from rehearsal every night to report the day's delicious blasphemy via her lips. She couldn't make a crack without mentioning somebody taking a shit on somebody's balls or, when no one but me was looking, pretending to masturbate furiously with the fervor of a cleaning lady scrubbing at a stubborn stain on a rug, only to play it completely cool when the attention of the other actors turned back upon us. She just makes me laugh like nobody else can, and has done so day in and day out for 13 years now. That's one of the many reasons they call me the lucky bastard. As a student of music myself, I have long dreamed of the opportunity to perform alongside Megan as she regales the audience with her brand of melodiousness. Recognizing this desire in me, she has coached me over the years to strengthen my singing voice with practice and hard work, until just in the last couple of years, to my great satisfaction, I've begun singing in front of audiences, mainly in my first humorist show, American Ham. Among the songs in my repertoire is The Rainbow Song, which I wrote in 2008 for Megan's 50th birthday. I had asked, it being her 50th, if she didn't crave something fancy in the way of a gift for this milestone age, some sort of bauble or gewgaw. An aside, Megan has had zero work done. By work, I refer, of course, to plastic surgery and Botox and all the other horrors that famous beautiful people traditionally inflict upon themselves. Let me just urge you, if you are contemplating anything in this realm, to please reconsider. There is nothing that a man or woman can do to improve upon nature. Your true self, no matter how much you dislike that self's lack of cheekbones, is the most beautiful version of you that can be presented to the world. And no amount of any doctor brutally butchering your flesh is going to buy you more adoration than simply your own personality, created by nature. And admitting that in some shitty arenas, having corrective surgeries actually does show dividends, do you really want the fruits of your life's labors to increase in bounty because you have bigger tits? Mightn't you be happier in another situation, wherein you were valued for the person inhabiting the body you showed up in? Implied answer, yes. For her 50th birthday gift, Megan said, "No, nothing special, just make me one of your cards or do one of your funny dances. Or you know what? I would actually love a rainbow for my birthday." I narrowed my eyes and scrutinized her face for a time, determining that no, she was not kidding. "Okay, honey," I said. "Cool. Sounds good. Let me make a few calls." Shitcakes. A motherfucking rainbow? I was stymied for a long time, racking my brain for some way to provide Megan with a birthday rainbow, her favorite color, by the way, and coming up short. When it looked as though all would be lost and I would fail miserably, I was saved by the late, great Nina Simone and her charming song, Beautiful Land, which lists the colors of the rainbow, one for each verse. Aha! I would live to fight another day. I wrote the following lyrics, and my dear friend, the wizardly mountebank Cornmo, helped me set them to some old Irish chords, creating my first song. Thanks again, Cornmo.com. The Rainbow Song.
You read me my rights when you arrested me. You put me on trial and gave me life. But orange, you're glad I didn't say banana. When you made me your bitch and I made you my wife. You yellow, you yell when I ball a melon. But you don't complain when I cook up some smack. We're both agreeing to serve our time. If I drop the soap, I know you'll watch my crack. Please enjoy this rainbow song. and this gift of leprechaun romance. Please enjoy as part of this well-balanced breakfast the lucky charms you will find in my pants. You blew me away when you sang Shock the Monkey. Your fingers inside me, let the games begin. Indigo is a tough one to pun with, but when we're apart, it's the mood that I'm in. We get along so well, we could never be compared to Jesus of Nazareth and Pontius Pilate. But if you'll endure the slight of calling me sir, I'll be Peppermint Patty to your Violet. Please let this song be your rainbow. I've got my Cialis, so I shall not fail. Please don't deny my advances, for tonight you're going to take it in the pail. That's the butt. Please let this song be your rainbow. I made it for you, this shit cuts like a knife. Forever I'll follow this rainbow to that 50-year-old sweet pot of gold that seems to grow foxy instead of old, from which I hope to never be paroled, my angel in a centerfold. She plays more than Sousa upon my fife, my jaw-droppingly beautiful wife.
Chapter 15. Finding Swanson. The secret to getting cast? Don't give a shit about the audition. The secret to that? Being happy at home, being happy in love, being happy in the rest of your life. Auditions are so depressing. There's a hallway full of dudes, and sometimes you see three dudes you know are fucking great, and it's horrible to see them because you think, oh, perfect, these three guys, they would all be ideal for this part. And then six other jerks, two of whom are your good friends. Or else there are a couple of those guys who like to try to psych you out. I had this one guy, I wish I could remember his name, so I could call him out in chapter 15 of my book. He's been breathing easy through this whole thing, thinking I didn't remember him, but now, here in this late chapter, I'm calling you out, bro. You know who you are, all macho and shadow boxing. Actually going outside the building and then staring me down through the window. We're actors, man. We're just actors. I'm not interested in fighting you or anyone. I didn't become a boxer or a soldier or a paramedic or a badass in any other way. I became an artist, and I'm afraid the same is true of you, using a loose interpretation of the term. It's so demoralizing. In this business that scores your abs so much higher than your enunciation, that the troglodytes can make it all the way through the filters to get a callback for a fireman pilot. Half the time, the people in the room for whom you're reading are barely even TV people. Sometimes they come from music videos or funny internet shorts or business school, that's the worst. They might be great people, even really creative ones, no question, but their main interest is just not in telling stories. It's easy to let yourself get down in the mouth when you're going to these auditions, because half the time what you have to offer, they can't even see. They don't have the right goggles. You're applying all of your powers of storytelling to a scene, with humor or tragic pathos, but they're viewing you through Coca-Cola glasses, musing over whether your role might do better demographically if you were more buff or blonde or Kardashian. It's important that you can set aside the idea that you wield an artistic agenda, as can the writer, hopefully, because the suits have an entirely different agenda, and that is to sell diapers and pick up trucks and breakfast cereal. You're working with an entirely different box of logic than they. Know that going in, and you're ahead of the game. These are just a tiny sampling of the delights of the audition process, but never fear. Once you have the right someone to come home to, be it even a pet or a poster of Billy Jack, you can then think, I don't fucking care. I can't make this corporation more artistic, so I'll just have fun here and do my best. As soon as you can flip that switch, as soon as you don't care as much, your work becomes so much better because you appear so much more confident. People think, hey, looks like you got something going on, buddy. After Megan and I got together, I started to religiously attend Will and Grace tapings, and I really hit it off with everybody in the cast and crew. I loved the show passionately. Being there while they were making the show was such a treat, especially watching all of these top-of-the-line professional artists doing their job so well. It couldn't have been more of a Disneyland for me, and there was also beer. They took a shine to me as well, which was awfully flattering. They'd written the role of a new boyfriend for Grace, Deborah Messing's character, and they held a bit of a cattle call, which included me auditioning with maybe 20 other guys. The next day, they had maybe 6 or 8 of us back to read more. I was pretty excited just to get a call back. The next day, Wednesday, they had 2 or 3 of us back. It was to read even more new material, and I realized this was all getting pretty crazy and real. They were really looking at me. On the Thursday, they had just me back by myself. Actually reading the scenes with Deborah for the producers and the director, television institution James Burroughs. They said, okay, we've written some new stuff. We really love you for this character. That funny little dance you do in the elevator is really working, but we can't give you the part yet. We're still working out some business, but it may go to you. In any case, we really love the stuff you're doing. Holy shit. The next day, Friday, they called and told me that Jim Burroughs had put in a call to Woody Harrelson back on Monday. They'd worked together on Cheers, and Woody had just now returned the call and said yes at the last minute. So you were great, but sorry. You know how it goes. And Woody went on and did this great part for the whole season and was, of course, awesome. There are some very good reasons that he's the big shot that he is, not the least of which are that he's incredibly lovely and charismatic and funny. So, unfortunately, there wasn't much to goddamn about. But I have to say, even just going through that experience was so thrilling and really did my confidence an immense deal of good. Just the fact that they considered me in that legitimate way was a dream come true. Later that fall, they were doing their Thanksgiving episode, and as a bit of a consolation, they gave me a small part as a plumber. I had these great scenes with Megan, and it was super fun, but I'd never done a multi-camera show before, so it was also kind of scary and stressful. Everything moves really quickly, especially with Jim Burroughs, who could do it with his eyes closed, and often does. He directs by ear more than eye. It's mighty impressive. There's not a lot of rehearsal, so I was nervous and had the live audience there to boot. I was about to make my first entrance of the night, and Sean Hayes is standing by the door saying, okay, here it comes, get ready. Getting close. Don't fuck this up. You ready? You ready? And making me giggle and freak out, I chased him away with as much composure, not much, as I could muster. Getting to do that role on Will and Grace was very fortifying for me. It made me feel like I could play with the professionals at the breakneck pace of a multi-camera sitcom. And getting to work with my lady, who had also quite quickly become my hero, was incredibly exhilarating. Shortly thereafter, I got cast in a Fox pilot called Secret Service. As a young actor, or really an actor of any age, starting out from scratch in L.A., you have to take whatever you can get. You have to build up your union points, first to earn your union cards, and then, with cards in hand, continue to qualify for your medical and dental insurance. Eventually, when you start getting jobs and doing a little better, should you be so lucky, it's hard to break the habit and begin saying no to any jobs. I remember auditioning for and getting a guest star job on this terrible Tom Sizemore show called Robbery Homicide Division. He was some sort of heroic homicide cop? I'm not sure, I never saw it. The part was some sort of psycho beating in a small child's head with a hammer. I had gone to the audition on autopilot